Ridiculous Danger presents Baron. I'm Natalie Flores. Yes, I'm the person to whom you've heard Peter Summers speaking. In this episode of Baron, we're going to address the events related to his family farm in Williamson, Ohio, detailed in recordings made by him in the fall of 1983. But first, I want to present one piece of information that will undoubtedly color everything that comes after and, more importantly, everything that came before. I never knew Peter Summers. He never worked for me in any capacity, and as far as my team can determine, he had no experience as a radio producer. Now, this is not to say that I'd never heard of him. On the contrary, I knew his name quite well. He signed it to a series of threatening letters he sent to WWNV, the station where I worked as an assistant. The letters, addressed to me, detailed his affections for me and grew increasingly angry over the weeks and months during the spring and summer of 1983. I don't have them anymore. The last time I saw them was when I turned them over to the police in August of that same year. And that was the same week I filed a restraining order against Peter. The letters stopped immediately after that. If I did still have them, I would not want to revisit them. Despite my decades of experience as a producer telling me that it would make for great radio, it's not a chapter in my life that I'd like to discuss. And even this part right now, discussing it right now, it's not pleasant for me. That said, I will return to one detail of the letters in a bit. For now, I want to present you with the scope of our research. Peter Summers' recordings were found by Detective Ron Tuttle on October 2, 1983, in a box in the home of John and Harriet Summers, with the exception of the final tape, which was found in a recording device in a barn on the property. All the tapes were labeled Attention Natalie Flores, WWNV. And that's how I became aware of them. The police entered them into evidence in the disappearance of Peter Summers and Callum McDonough, and they informed me of their existence and contents. The initial concern was that Peter went into hiding or faked his death in an effort to get to me, especially because of moments like this.
You should see it sometime, Nat. Maybe I could give you a tour or something if we have any follow-up interviews or something to do. There's such beauty for me to show you.
A patrol car sat outside my house every night for 3 weeks. With no evidence of activity from Peter, no sightings, no bank activity, that sort of thing, the investigation became a missing person case, and I was left to my own devices. I did listen to the tapes, though. It took years for me to build up the will to do so. And, like I'm sure most of you, I was left with far more questions than answers. As part of our research for this series, we sent the tapes to Citheron Audio in Los Angeles. They mostly do sound mixing and mastering for TV and film, but they also specialize in analyzing audio for criminal cases. They can detect fakes, splices, impersonators, and other forms of audio trickery. And their consulting contracts with the FBI, CIA, Homeland Security, and the DOJ, and countless state and local law enforcement agencies show that they are quite simply the best in the business. We asked them if Peter Summers' tapes were faked and if any part was doctored. Their official answer was, aside from the obvious splicing of the recording of John Summers, we found no evidence that the Summers audio files were doctored in any way. However, our methods cannot detect whether other individuals aided in the creation of the unusual sounds captured in many of the files. So the audio experts say the tapes themselves were not doctored, but the actions on the tapes could have been faked. That raises some questions. Was Peter correct? Were the town folk trying to drive him out? And if so, did they do it by playing sounds from some sort of PA system? Or was it all part of an elaborate con Did Peter plan all of it? Or did he have an accomplice? Was Callum McDonough in on it? And of course, the ultimate question. Is this real? Even dismissing a supernatural explanation, every possible conclusion you could draw is sinister. Much like Peter's own experience, finding people to go on the record for this series has proven challenging, though for different reasons. Peter's return to Williamson was so brief, very few in town remember any details about it. Those that do talk of it like a local legend, much the way people around Loch Ness speak of occasionally seeing the tall, slender neck breaking the surface of the water during the moonlit night. As for those directly involved, we had even less luck. They were unable to track down any of McDonough's kin. Dr. Alexandra Watts, the town veterinarian, died of colon cancer in 2003. And Nathan Greer, the deputy stationed in Williamson during the events of the recordings, was killed during a traffic stop in 1992. A truck driver lost control and struck Greer as he was returning to his cruiser to run a motorist's plates. We found Norma Lewis, the woman that confronted Peter in the Bailey Street diner, and whom he assaulted later that afternoon. Now in her 80s, she suffers from Alzheimer's-related dementia. It seems the only person with direct involvement who's still alive is Detective Tuttle. Now retired, he too refused to be interviewed on air for our story, but he did help us get a copy of the interrogation you heard in the previous episode. In all his years, the unsolved murder of Callum McDonough plagued him. He remains certain Peter killed him to cover up whatever was going on at the Summers farm.
That blood on your shirt, that's not your blood. And while we don't have a body, we do have the fact that Mr. McDonough cannot be located. And we have your grandfather's recently fired shotgun and powder burns on your hands. It doesn't look good, Peter.
Despite his efforts, the sheer lack of evidence meant the trail went cold within months. It should be noted that during his investigation, no evidence of any unusual creatures was ever found. No tracks, no remains, no droppings. When I asked Detective Tuttle what he thought happened to Peter, he said, quote, "I think the devil snatched him back into the hell that spat him out in the first place," end quote.
Let's face it, getting healthy sucks. And staying healthy? Yeah, good luck with that. Well, thankfully, there's a new book out there that actually makes wellness seem doable. It's called Pretty Sure You're Fine, the health and wellness guide for hypochondriacs, overthinkers, and worrywarts. It's out now from Chronicle Books. See, David Viena, the mastermind behind the best-selling parenting manual Calm the Fuck Down, he's now set his sights on the health and wellness industry. He's calling out all the fads, myths, and scams, and revealing the truth beyond the fear-mongering. Because let's face it, chances are, you're probably in better shape physically and mentally than you think. And plus, the next big idea club, named Pretty Sure You're Fine, a must-read. And those people are pretty smart. So whether you need reassurance that you're not a complete disaster, or just a little extra motivation to keep going, grab a copy of Pretty Sure You're Fine. It's available now, wherever books are sold.
We've speculated some. Now let's offer some things that we know to be true. Cover-to-cover books did exist in Williamson, and it was run by Callum until his disappearance in 1983. In fact, all of the people and places Peter mentioned are or were real. His grandparents did commit joint suicide by setting their cornfield on fire and walking into it. All of that, I'm sure you'd expect. But remember the vines Peter found?
I'm looking at new growth. Some sort of vine or weed. Oh, wow. It's everywhere.
From the fall of 83 to the summer of 87, those unidentifiable bleeding weeds, as the town folks called them, covered the Summers property, but only the property. It didn't grow beyond the tree line or out into the road. It flourished, unattended, solely within the confines of the summer's land. It was such a phenomenon that the Chillicothe Daily News did a write-up on it, and that got the attention of the research team from Northern Cincinnati University. In 1985, students came to collect samples, but according to the research data we found in the university archives, the study was abandoned because all of the samples disintegrated before reaching the lab. Not died, disintegrated. After years of neglect, they eventually all died off. Nearly 4 years. Not bad for the run of a crop that was never seeded and never tended. Peter also was truthful about the book collection. Those books and all those other possessions were all auctioned off by the county to pay for back taxes owed by John and Harriet. The county record of the auction is the only proof that the books existed, as Callum did not keep records of his more scandalous acquisitions. The property, including the house and barn, were up for auction as well, but there were no bidders. So though they are dilapidated and empty, the house and barn stand on that property to this day. There's one final detail I'd like to address. The recording of John Summers. In that recording, John admits he was behind the murder of Peter's mother, Alice Summers. And the weapon he wielded was his own son.
You know how those that leave the flock must be dealt with. Your goddamn mother threatened to destroy everything. Why, he killed her. Why, I had him kill her.
What troubled me more is how Peter reacted.
Oh, this can't be real. This can't be real. This can't be real. This can't be real. Something existed before time. The things that attacked Callum, it wasn't any wild animal. And the barn, he said, close the barn door. No, he said the door in the barn. What does that even mean? The barn's locked tight. Or is it?
He focused on the phrase, existed before time. The animal that allegedly attacked Callum and the barn. Not the stunning revelation that his own grandfather orchestrated the murder of his mother. As unthinkable as it sounds, this tells me Peter already knew. Peter knew about his grandfather's involvement and, more so, was okay with it. Then there's this mention of the flock. How those that leave the flock must be dealt with. Of all of the details in the story, that word, flock, chilled me to my core. And that's because in 1983, in one of Peter's vile letters to me, he made reference to his flock and how I was part of his flock, and for John, the word flock meant more than just your family or your parishioners. It meant something you could never leave. Peter's father knew this. Peter knew this. This kind of behavior, this language of control is not unusual. You hear it. You hear it from cult leaders, from religious extremists, from the clinically insane. John's influence over the family seems rooted in abuse and a cult-like mentality that demanded loyalty and subservience. Even as he was about to walk into a fire and die by emulation, he still demanded loyalty. Okay. So we know that John and Harriet died, and there are police and autopsy reports to prove it. We know both Peter and Callum went missing and are presumed dead. We know the strange animal sounds on the tape could not be verified, and most other evidence, including witness reports, are either missing or never manifested in the first place. So why tell this story? If these tapes have existed for decades, why am I finally doing this story? Over the years, I rose through the ranks to become an award-winning radio producer. I retired 6 years ago at the top of my game. I could have done this story at any time. Why am I doing it now? Why did I come out of retirement to do this story now? Here's where I'm going to suggest something. A little difficult to believe. Bear with me. Let's assume for the moment that some of the more far-fetched parts of the story are true. Let's assume John and Harriet were studying demonology or Satanism. Let's assume the wild animals Peter heard, caught, and by which he was attacked were not normal, maybe even unworldly. Let's assume the recording John left Peter was not the rambling of a sick mind, but a real warning about a real demonic ritual. Okay. Are you still with me? On that tape, John said this.
Ritual cannot go unfinished. If we fail, if our sacrifice fails, it's up to you.
Now, the word evitus. Lifetime in Latin. Peter said he found it written twice. Callum said it meant lifetime, and John said he thought the phrase he found meant two lives. But Peter was right when he asked whether evitus might have another translation. It can also mean generation. Written twice, could that mean two generations? Because if so, the ritual needed a sacrifice of two generations. And while a grandmother and a grandfather are not two generations, a grandmother and a grandson are. And if Peter willingly or unwillingly completed the ritual by going into the barn, that would mean an extra life had been sacrificed unnecessarily. What happens to an unnecessary sacrifice? What happens to that life? I received a voicemail last month. The call originated from a payphone on State Route 62, outside Williamson.
Hello, Natalie. Sorry it took me so long. My grandson Peter told me all about you. He's so happy to count you as a member of our flock. I can't wait to meet you. There's such beauty for me to show you.
Baron is created by David Vienna and is a Ridiculous Danger production. For episode credits and more information, visit baronpodcast.com. Please don't forget to rate and review on your favorite podcast platform.